From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hi everybody, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. It's a sad episode today. The family of squadron leader George Leonard Johnson, Johnny Johnson, have announced that Johnny died at the age of 101 on December the 7th, 2022. Johnny Johnson was the last surviving member of the original 617 Squadron who took part in Operation Chastise, the Dam Busters raid in May 1943. He was the last Dam Buster. I was lucky enough to meet Johnny several times in my career. I remember going way back into the early noughties. He came as a hardy, healthy man in his 80s, drove himself up to Derbyshire, where we walked the Derbyshire dams on which the Dam Busters trained. Little did I think then, as we went to the pub afterwards and had a few beers and dinner, how rare and extraordinary this opportunity was. As the years went by and the group of veterans from that conflict dwindled, it started to feel more and more special every time I met him. I saw him in Lincoln and I used to go and visit him in his care home, where he sat down very kindly and gave me an interview for the History Hit podcast just as I was starting out. That is the episode that we're repeating today on the podcast so we can celebrate the passing of a national treasure. Thank you, Johnny, for a lifetime of service. And thank you personally for being so nice to me and allowing me to bother you and record your words for posterity. Here he is. R.I.P. Enjoy.
T-10.
Atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first some black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Can I ask first about your upbringing? Because it was quite a tough childhood you had.
My mother died a fortnight before my third birthday. So I never knew a mother's love. And I had a father, who, whether he blamed me for my mother's death, I don't know. But the first thing I remember about him was we were at the hospital waiting to go up to see my mother. And he was talking to somebody else. I went up to join them. And he explained to this character who I was. I was the sixth of the family, the youngest of six. And this guy said, what, another one? My father said, yes, it's a mistake. Thank you very much. I remember that from that age. And from then on, as far as he was concerned, I was a mistake. And as with most men, used a cutthroat razor for shaving. And the strop was hung on the back of the kitchen door. And if that shop came down, and he wasn't shaving, I knew where it was headed, right across my back, and that was it. And that was the sort of upbringing that I started with. And my sister almost became my surrogate mother. She was 7 years older than me. My father treated her much the same he treated me, not hitting her, but he argued her daughter was there to look after her father in the way he wanted it done, at the time that he wanted it done. And that was it. And what is now Lord Wandsworth College in Hampshire was Lord Wandsworth Agricultural College in my day. And it was bequeathed by Lord Wandsworth for the children of agricultural families that lost one or both parents, and everything was free. Well, the head teacher of our elementary school heard about this. She applied on my behalf, and I was interviewed. I was offered a place. My father said no. At 14, he leaves school, he goes out and gets a job and brings some money into the house. The teacher was so furious about this. We had a squire, still got a squire in the small village. She went to see the squire's wife and told her the story. And the squire's wife went to see my father and told him his fortune in no uncertain terms, how he was ruining my chances of a better education and a much better future life. He ought to be ashamed of himself. No, I suppose I'd better let him go then. And that was it.
Do you remember being happy as a child, or was it just hard?
It was hard at that stage. And at 11, I went over to Lord Wandsworth, and that's when life really started. And it was so different, and so much different from what I've been used to. One interesting thing, there was a junior school there, which of course I joined in. I had a fairly rough skin on my face, and the matron treated it with lard. I was known as Lardy Face from any. And about almost 4 years ago now, I had a telephone call, and the caller said, "Is that Lardy?" I said, "My God, that must be from Lord Wandsworth." One of the other old boys as well.
Growing up, you as an agricultural, labouring family.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever dream that one day you might join the RAF, this glamorous aviation service?
No dream about that sort of thing. As Lord Wandsworth, my original ambition was to be a vet. But my school certificate results weren't quite as good as they might have been. I passed, yes. When I left school, I thought, it was time I got into this war. Having seen the films of the First World War with the trench fighting, the army was out as far as I was concerned. I didn't like water anyway, so the Navy was out. It just left me the Air Force. But I didn't want to be a pilot. I didn't feel I had the coordination or the aptitude. And at that age, I wanted to go bomber rather than fighter. I knew that bomber pilots were responsible for the safety of the crew as a whole. And I didn't think I had the responsibility for that either. However, when it came to the selection committee, they made me change my mind and selected me for pilot training. And that was sort of a standby for almost a year before we started the training.
Why did you join the RAF, though, when war broke out?
Basically, because I think I'd felt so much against Hitler.
So you, even in the 1930s, you knew Hitler was an evil force in the world?
That's right, yes, yes. Well, only because, basically, of the reaction, what he was doing to this country, the bombing and so on, at that stage. That was the basic reason behind it. And I felt I wanted to get back to him as much as I could. And the only way to do that was joining one of the services.
Tell me how you came to be on 617 Squadron.
Well, the pilot training. I eventually ended up in America. And we had two training schemes out there, the British Flying Training School and the rest with the American Army Air Corps. I got one of the Army Air Corps stations. Nice posting, Florida, Arcadia in Florida. But I could not stand the Army Air Corps. Their petty discipline and their sloppy marching really got up my nose. Fortunately, the instructors were civilians and decent people. But I managed to solo. But my landings weren't quite what they ought to have been. And he said to me one day, "I'm sorry, old son, I don't think you're going to make it." I said, "Don't be sorry, neither do I." And I joined a group, there were about 10 of us, washed out pilots. And we went back to Maxwell Field in Montgomery, still with the Army Air Corps. We weren't supposed to talk going into breakfast, so we sang Colonel Bogey, just for the hell of it. And our senior member was a flight sergeant gunner who'd been hoping to reach out as a pilot. And on the last morning, he said, "Let's show these so-and-sos how to march." So we fell in RAF style outside the dining room, then marched back to the billet, 160 paces to the minute, arms swinging waist high, forwards and backwards, just as it had been at ITW. And the looks we got from these people as we went by, at least we felt we'd left our mark on Maxwell Field. But then it was back to Canada to wait for a ship to bring us home. And it was January of 1942 by the time I got back into this country. No nearer to fighting that war than I had been when I joined. What was the shortest course? And it was gunnery. So I took the gunnery course. And again, going through the acceptance process, the president said, "I think you'd be afraid to be a gunner, Johnson." I said, "I don't think so, sir. If I were, I wouldn't have volunteered anyway." End of this exercise, that conversation. But I got past the gunnery exam. And instead of being posted to an OTU, which is the usual thing, you posted to an OTU when you finished your aircrew training and you met the rest of the crew members, joined up a crew, and then moved out for further training. But not me. I was posted direct to 97 Squadron at Woodhall as a spare gunner, which meant I had to fly with anybody who hadn't got a mid-upper or a rear gunner for that night's operations for various reasons. Quite an inauguration into operational flying. But we managed to get through.
What was your first operational sortie?
A failure. The first one, I was flying with one of the squadron flight commanders, and we were carrying the 8,000-pound bomb. And nobody had been successfully dropped one of these up to that stage. And we were going to do it. So we took off and went on board. Flying across the North Sea, I was in the mid-upper turret. Swung round, I see petrol streaming out of one of the engines. I called up the captain. He said, "Oh dear." He said, "I'm sorry, chaps, we'll have to go back." So we didn't drop the 8,000 pounder either. We just landed with it still on. However, by that time, 97 had been re-equipped with Lancasters, and they were looking for the seventh member of crew, the bomb aimer, and they were training him locally. And since it made a difference between 7 and 6 and 12 and 6 a day, I thought I'd have a go at that. So I retrained as a bomb aimer and came back to 97 as a spare bomb aimer.
When did you first fire your weapon as a mid-upper gunner, though, before you retrained?
I only fired in practice, that sort of thing, just to test the guns. And that was the same as a bomb aimer. I had to fly in the front turret on the way out, down to drop the bombs at the target, back into the front turret on the way back, as part of the, still part of the eyes of the rest of the crew. And that was one of the things about the crews generally. I think the majority, I'm sure the majority, of the bomber command air crew were there to do the job that they'd been briefed for to the best of their ability. And that meant not only the job, their individual job, but their responsibility to the rest of the crew, for the safety, where they might be responsible for the safety of the rest of the crew. And that was common throughout the whole thing. When I asked about my 10th trip on this spare body, I was told I was joining this crew with an American pilot. And my immediate reaction was, "Oh my God, bloody Americans again." And then I met Joe McCarthy, 6'3" and the breadth to go with the height. Big in size, big in personality. But from our point of view, big in palatability, which was tremendous confidence. Certainly with me, I never once thought of Joe not bringing me back. And he didn't, of course.
What's your first memory of being above occupied Europe, dropping bombs on targets below?
Well, the first memory is that at that time we were flying out of Moon, supposedly for defensive reasons. So it's pretty dark all the way out. I fly 10, 12, maybe 15,000 feet. You didn't see anything until you got to the target area. And then you saw all the guns that you'd got to go through before you went home. People say to me, "Were you frightened?" I said, "Well, I think anyone who saw that for the first time, if they weren't a bit apprehensive, were either devoid of emotion, or strangers to the truth.
What's it like looking up at... You can see flares that the Pathfinders have dropped, have you? And you can see anti-aircraft fire just swirling up all around you.
Yeah. I found my concentration was purely on the bombsight and the target. I'm concentrating, directing the pilot to get my bombs as close as I could to that particular target. Whatever was going on round about me, I just didn't see it. It didn't concern me. I was doing my job, so I thought, to the best of my ability. And that was what I considered I was there for. And so, strange as it may seem, I didn't notice the flak that was coming around. I didn't notice the other aircraft in the area until I'd dropped my bombs. And we then had to fly straight and level for the camera to operate. And so when we got back, the intelligence could see where we dropped our bombs in spite of what we said. And so that was that. But
and would you see other Lancasters being hit and crews bailing out and falling out of the sky?
I didn't ever see any of that. Although I understand it happened. I know it happened. I've certainly aircraft shot down over the target area. And either by anti-aircraft guns, or there are times when they brought the fighters into the target area as well. And it was a pretty rough old journey, basically. But you didn't have time to worry about it. At least I didn't. And the only time I think I was a bit apprehensive, more than a bit apprehensive, was before I joined Joe's crew. I was flying with an old NCO crew. And they were coming close to their last trip in the first tour. And we'd been up to Wismar in the north of Germany. And as usual, the weather was dead loss when we got there. So it's aerial marking. And you'd no idea where your bombs went. You just bombed the target and that the marker, and that was it. And coming back, as soon as you drop below 10,000 feet, oxygen off, and usually cigarettes on as well. But on this occasion, we just dropped our masks off. There's a God almighty flash, absolutely blind all round. Couldn't see a thing. And I was in the front turret by that time. And as an eyesight came back, it looked almost as though the perspex had been burnt out. It was just the metal strips there. But as the eyesight came back, it came, the turret was completely intact. And the Mizuba gunner was calling, "Are you all right, Colin?" Colin was the pilot, obviously fighting like mad with the aircraft that was going down without no uncertain terms. And he kept on with this. And in the end he said, "My God, they've all gone. I'm going to get out." The wireless operator went back to him and told him to stop being such a bloody idiot. And not quite so politely as that. How could Colin possibly answer? Without his oxygen mask on, his microphone was away from his mouth, and he was fighting like mad to save the aircraft and us and you stupid so-and-so. When we got back, and he was in a rather pleasant mood, he said he saw the St. Elmo's fire creeping up the aerial towards his turret, and then woof, was a lightning flash, and it really was a heller. We dropped from 10, or just below 10, to 2,000 feet, just like that. But Colin got it controlled at 2,000 feet. I didn't bother to find out what had happened to the aircraft when we got back. I just got out of it and that was it.
Did the experience of flying like that bring you very close? Did you make great mates in those conditions?
Yes. Apart from the fact, I was the odd one out in that I didn't drink, believe it or not. I've managed to change that habit, but still. The reason, again, goes back to childhood, where our father, being a farm foreman, during the lambing season, he stayed up most of the night, nipping out to see that the lambs and the ewes were all right. was asleep in his chair in between. And he'd had his beer. And even in those days, at that level of personality, we drank the beer out of the glass, not out of the bottle. And so the bottle and the glass, both empty or thereabouts, on the table the night passed. I thought, oh, I'll try that. And I tipped the dregs of one into the glass. And, yo God, flat as hell, tasted horrible. But the smell, that's what really got me. It literally made me sick. And that smell stayed with me. I couldn't stand the smell of beer from then onwards. So I didn't get into the bar, the pubs, or even into the mess bar, except for a quick trip at lunchtime to get me cigarettes, and that was it. I enjoyed my war. I think I felt I was doing what I'd joined for, and I was doing it to the best of my ability. And that was what I was there for. But I enjoyed doing it. And so much so, with the confidence in my pilot and the rest of the crew that I flew with. We had a crew comedian. That was Dave Roger in the rear turret. He could always make some cryptic comment whenever the situations were a bit grim. Like, as we were coming back from the dams raid, must have been partially my fault. We obviously got off track and we ended up on a railway. Not only a railway, but a railway yard. But of course, it wasn't a normal railway yard. It was the ham marshalling yard, where all the munitions that were made in the rear were distributed to various areas of the war. Obviously not the healthiest of places to be at the end of May in 1943. There again, down goes Joe. And from the rear turret, who needs guns? At this height, all they need to do is change the points. And that was the sort of thing that Dave could come up with at that time.
Did you ever think about what was going on the ground? You were dropping these bombs, smashing buildings, killing people. Did you think about that?
No. I think the only respect with which I thought about it was it was basically retaliation. What Hitler was doing and had done to us. I think that was all it was. I think maybe from that childhood upbringing, emotion was basically knocked out of me. I don't think I had any particular strong emotion at all. And that's why I didn't feel, I put that on partially, I didn't ever feel frightened about the flying. Or the actual bombing. And I didn't really appreciate what it meant to those at the receiving end. I didn't find that out until after the war, when I went back and talked to some German people.
Let's talk about the formation of 617. Was it an elite force? Was it exciting to be part of this new organisation?
Yeah. Well, the first we heard of it was that Gibson, oh, I beg his pardon, Wing Commander Gibson, rang Joe and asked, would he join this special squadron he was forming for one special trip? We were just coming towards the end of our first tour then. Joe said, well, I'll have to ask my crew, which he did, and we agreed to go with him. After a first tour, normal practice was at least a week's leave, and then you went on to a ground tour or an operational flying tour until you were required back on ops. In the past, I'll try it again. Looking forward to that leave, my fiancé and I had arranged to get married on April the 3rd. So I thought, I wrote to her and said, this is what was happening, but don't worry, it won't make any difference. The letter I got back just said, if you're not there on April the 3rd, don't bother. I thought, aye, the first mandate's been issued. But there we go. Anyway, we left to that. Moved over to Scampton. And the first thing we heard was no leave. Oh, God, there goes my wedding. However, Joe took us up as a crew to Gibson's office. And he said, we've just finished our first tour. We're entitled to a week's leave. My boy was supposed to be getting married on April 3rd, and he's going to get married on April 3rd. We got our leave, and I got my wedding, so that was that. But that, again, was typical of Joe looking after his crew in there.
Was Guy Gibson a terrifying figure, or was he a great leader?
My reaction has to be retrospective. As we were in the same squadron, that was all I could say about it. His basic problem was he was unable to bring himself down to mix and talk with lower ranks. Even junior officers on the duty side, if the only time they'd be spoken to was to get a bollocking if they'd done something that they shouldn't have done on duty. I gather he was quite a boy in the mess with the games and fun that went on in there. He was bombastic. He was autocratic, a strict disciplinarian, which didn't go down very well with the aircrew, of course. And on 106 Squadron, which he'd commanded before he came over to 617, he was known as the Arch Bastard. And that summed him up pretty well. Mind you, he had done... if he wasn't most experienced... Well, he was one of the most experienced bomber pilots in the command. He'd done two tours of bomber operations and one tour of night operations. And at this stage, he was only 24 years of age. So he had something to be arrogant about. So I think when he came to 617, he realised he'd got to get more out of that squadron than out of any of the others. He didn't know at that stage what the target was. Apart from the fact, he was just a special target. He got everything he could for the squadron. There was an instance where something he wanted, and he rang group. They said, sorry, we can't do that. So he rang command, and they gave him the same answer. He said, right, I'll ring the Air Ministry. And he did. And the Air Ministry gave him the same answer. So he said, right, I'll sit in my office until you change your mind. And he did, and they did, and he got what he wanted. That was typical of his reaction. But he was obviously an action man. And his true indication of his leadership came with the raid itself, the dam's raid itself, where he and his crew made the first attack on the Moan Dam, which we knew was the only dam that was defended. And apart from dropping his bomb, he wanted to assess those defences at the same time. And then after, as he called each aircraft in, he flew alongside them to attract some of that defence. That to me says, you're doing this, I'm doing this, we're doing it together.
You listen to Dan Snow's History. Don't go anywhere, there's more to come.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, from stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California to shooting for the moon with Apollo, we've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life?
Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A-frames.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Lancasters of 617 Squadron flew by night to destroy the dams of the Myrna, Eder and Sult, the heartbeat of industrial Germany. Each bomber carried a new type of bomb specially devised for the raid by Barnes Wallace. Here, Dr. Wallace greets wartime members of the squadron arriving for a reunion at RAF Scampton. Fittingly, they came in a Lancaster. Trying the feel of a tail gunner's turret again is Jerry Witherick, an air gunner on the mission. The flight deck of a Lank. Surviving the mission, Squadron Commander Guy Gibson won a VC, and his squadron won an immortal title, the Dambusters.
When you were training up in Derbyshire, what do you think was going on with this strange bomb that was being strapped to the Lancaster, the changes that were made? What on earth was happening?
I think we were getting more fun out of the actual flying. To think about worrying what was happening. We knew it was a special target, we'd been told that. We'd also been told there had to be complete security about what we were doing, and we told no one about the type of training that we were doing. But the interest in that training, of course, was at low level. The prescribed height was 100 feet. Very few people flew at 100 feet. It tended to be rather lower than that. And there were occasions when the old aircraft came back with a few tree branches stuck in the wings or something like that, you know. But in Lincolnshire, there's a town called Sutton Bridge. But as you fly up from the south, the electric cables also cross the bridge. Now, this practice wasn't briefed, but everybody did it just for the hell of it. And we flew under the cables and up over the bridge. Great thrill that was, wonderful fun. And I learned subsequently that one of our residents here, he had an aunt living in Sutton Bridge at that time. And she said all the people in Sutton Bridge were scared stiff about all these low-flying aircraft. But that's war, dear. There's a trouble.
And did you drop this strange bouncing bomb in training, or was the first time never dropped?
No. No, we didn't even spin it, but that comes later. We started off with our only means of navigation was map reading and dead reckoning. Navigator and bomb MH had a map with a track marked out, and the navigator would indicate what I should be seeing. If I saw it, that was fine. If I didn't, I picked out something else equally prominent, and he could adjust his courses, if necessary, on that. The bombers had to make their own bomb site, and it consisted of a triangle of plywood with a peg in each angle. But the distance between the base pins had to be specific, and the distance from the base to the apex had to be equally specific. And on the bombing range, they arranged two poles specific distances apart. And the practice was that the bomber had a single pin to his eye and directed the pilot until the two base pins were in line with the two poles and dropped the bomb. Practice bombs, I hasten to add. And if you got it right, first time, great. If you didn't, you did again, and again, and again, until you got it right. Until we've got to the stage where I think most of us were fairly accurate with our bombing. But we're also using some of the dams in this country for bombing practice. Most notably, Derwent Water in Derbyshire. And it had towers, so we could use those for sighting. It also had a marker in the reservoir which showed where the bomb should drop. And you use the same approach as you had on the range. And if your bomb dropped close to that marker, that was fine.
Did you have any idea what the target was then? Yeah, what you were practicing on these? What did you think it was?
We didn't think. Too young to worry about it then. That was another thing about.
How old were you at this point?
At that stage, I was 21. But at this stage, when we first joined the squadron, one of the things that struck us was the experience of the crews. Most of them had done one tour, some were on their second tour. The next thing was the aircraft, special aircraft. Yes, a Lancaster of a court. No mid-upper turret, and it seems as though the bomb doors were sealed, and there is two legs standing down, one either side of the fuselage in the front, just below the nose, just behind the nose. What the hell was that for? And then the bomb arrived. It was just like a glorified big dustbin. But at least it indicated to us what those legs were for. They obviously were going to carry that bomb when it was loaded onto the aircraft. And that was as far as we got with it. We went through the training with these cross countries, bombing practices, and then we went into a twilight situation where the front perspex of the cabin and the nose were covered in blue sheeting, and the pilot and the bomber wore night vision glasses, and that created a twilight situation. What I never understood was how you were supposed to map read over the North Sea, because one of our turning points was over the North Sea. However, you had to hope like hell you crossed our point, our coast, in the right place, and you hit the right place as you came back on dead reckoning. And from there, on to bright moonlight night flying. It had to be bright moonlight. Until it got to the stage where Gibson thought we were fit to go. We still had no idea what the target was. He'd been told by then. And I think certainly the bombing leader, Bob Hay, had been told. And on the Saturday night before the raid, we met as a squadron. Majority of it really met Barnes Wallis for the first time. And he explained, showed us film of his development of the bomb, how it had been developed, how difficult it had been to get it right in the first place. And then he told us something about the bomb itself. It weighed 9,000 pounds, of which 6,500 was explosive within that bomb, fused with two depth fuses to explode at a depth of 25 feet, but also fused with a self-destruct fuse. And we learned out subsequently why. And then I think it was probably the highest powered briefing I attended throughout my operational career. The AOC was there, station commander, Gibson, of course, was there doing the briefing, Barnes Wallis and going to the briefing too, senior officers of armament and engineering from the station were there, intelligence officer, and the dear old Metman was there too. Well, Gibson explained the trip to us. The first thing we saw, of course, when we got in the operations room, was that the two models were there, one of the Mohn and one of the Zilpa. One on the Ada hadn't been fitted, hadn't been completed. So it obviously
the models of the dams?
Yes. And that was how we found out what the target is going to be. How wrong can you be? On the previous evening, after Barnes Wallace's talk, the conjecture was it was going to be German battleships, notably the Tirpitz. Because when you dropped that bomb, it was being rotated at 500 revs a minute backwards. Yes. And it had to be dropped from exactly 60 feet at a ground speed of 200 knots. And so it became a sort of four men flying of the aircraft. Navigator watching the lights when they can up or down until they were coincident. That was the exact height. Flight engineer watching the speed and indicating when it was up or down. And the bomber directing the pilot to the target. It meant the pilots were being told by three other members of the crew how to fly the aircraft, but they didn't seem to complain too much about it. And that was the way it was going to be. And Gibson, in the briefing, explained that he would take off with two others and they'd head for the Mön. And they would attack the Mön when they got there. Six others in 2-3s would follow him, and they too would head for the Mön. And if the Mön hadn't been breached by the time they got there, they would attack that under Gibson's direction. And when that was breached, they would move over to the Eider. That was 9 of the crews briefed. 5, of which we were one, were briefed for the Zorpa. And of course, the Zorpa had to be different from the other two. It had no towers, so there was nothing to sight on. And it was so placed in the hills that a head-on attack was virtually impossible, certainly extremely difficult. And so we were briefed. We had to fly down one side of the hills with the port outer engine over the dam itself and fly along the dam and estimate to drop the bomb as near as possible to the centre of the dam. With the port engine over the dam, the bomb obviously was on the water side. We were a big disappointment because it meant we weren't going to use any of the bombing practices we'd been doing for the last 6 weeks. But that was what we had to do, so that was the job. Went back then to the messes for the usual operational bacon and eggs meal before you went. That was a time when, in the science mess, some wit would say to a captain, if you don't come back, can I have your sausage? But that sort of thing was taking good form. But it was then out the aircraft. And then came our big shock. Because Kew Queen, I know it's Quebec now, but it was Kew Queen in those days, decided it did want to go that night. And it developed a hydraulic leak on run-up, which couldn't be fixed in time for takeoff. So there was only one reserve aircraft, and that had come in at 3 o'clock that afternoon. It had been bombed up, fueled up, and it had done a compass swing with the bomb on board to offset the metal of that bomb against the aircraft compasses. As soon as we knew we weren't going to be able to take Queen, Joe said, for Christ's sake, get that reserved before some other bugger gets there and we don't get to go.
So you guys wanted to go?
Yeah, oh yes.
You're excited?
Oh yes. So that was the way it went. In his hurry to get there, he pulled his parachute. So it was blooming behind him as he went up as a reserve aircraft.
Did it feel different to other raids you'd been on?
Oh yes, very much so. We knew how special it was. And of course, he was explained by the intelligence officer why the raid was so important, because of the damage that we'd do to the German armament industry. That was the basic point behind it. And when we got to spare aircraft, the compass card for that last compass swing wasn't in the aircraft. Joe, I don't think he used the same, had a tremendous vocabulary. I don't think he used the same word twice. He was so furious. He got into the truck and down to the flights. Fortunately, the squadron adjutant was there, old Humph, and he said, "For Christ's sake, Joe, calm down. If you don't, you'll make a complete pig's ear of the whole thing." And that calmed him down a bit. However, we had a very good flight sergeant, he said, Chiefy Powell, and he went over to the flights to collect the compass card. But he'd heard Joe say he wasn't going to bother with the parachute. So he detoured to the parachute section and he picked up another parachute. Went back to the truck, gave Joe the compass card in the front, put the parachute in the back and said, "Your parachute, sir." Flights on to a flight lieutenant didn't make much difference in those days. But there we are. Joe had got a parachute and that was it. And so eventually we got back to the aircraft and we were about half an hour late taking off. When we got flying some distance south of Ham, and there was a good strain travelling up at right angles to our track. And because we had no mid-upper turret, the mid-upper gunner was flying in the front turret. Fortunately, they'd fitting stirrups, so he wasn't kicking me up the backside all the time. But then, when we saw this train, he said, "Can I have a go, Joe?" And I think somewhat reluctantly, Joe said, "Well, yes, all right then." And Ron opened up with these little 303s. That's all we had in the front turret. What we didn't know, of course, was it wasn't just a goods train. It was an armoured goods train. And it replied with rather more than 303s. We knew we'd been hit, we heard it, and we felt it. But it didn't seem to impede the aircraft at all, so we carried on. And we eventually found the Zorpa. The first thing we noticed, which we should have probably, if it was on the model, we should have seen, was a church steeple on the side of the hill down which we were supposed to come. Joe used that as a marker, tried to align the aircraft as best he could at that position, and then went down. Because we weren't spinning the bomb, it was an inert drop. The actual position, the conditions for dropping it didn't apply. So it didn't matter about the height or the speed at which we dropped it. We hadn't practiced that type of attack at all. And it wasn't easy. If I wasn't satisfied, I called dummy run. If Joe wasn't satisfied, he just pulled away and left me to call dummy run. This is where Dave Roger in the rear turret came up. Not in a humorous vein. And so a voice from the rear turret out about the sixth or seventh of these dummy runs. "Won't somebody get that bum out of here?" And I had to realise how to become the most unpopular member of crew in double quick time. But that was my job. And that was what I was there for.
So how many times did you go over the dam to try and get it right?
Yeah. Then we had to go up again. And in retrospect, I can understand to some degree Dave's anxiety, because his job basically was the safety of the aircraft from enemy fighters. And each time he went up, came back over the village, there's nothing to stop somebody down there ringing up the authorities and saying, "They're bombing our dam at that moment." And of course, that would have brought the fights in. Bye-bye McCarthy's crew, just like that. And that would have been part of his apprehension, I think. But then, on the 10th run, neither Joe nor I had said anything to us about height, each other about height. But I'm sure we both realised that the lower we got, the less forward travel that bomb would have before it hit the water. And secondly, the lower we got, the easier it'd be to estimate the dropping point. On that 10th run, we were down to 30 feet. And when I said, "Bomb gone," thank Christ came from the rear turret, just like that. And because it was so low, his nose up straight away, so I didn't see the explosion. But Dave did in the rear turret. And he estimated that the Tower of Water went up to about 1,000 feet. Well, if you imagine 6,500 pounds of explosive being detonated at a depth of 25 feet is going to move a hell of a lot of water in all directions, upwards as well as outwards. And that was what he saw. And yet not only that, but in the downflow flow, some of it came into the turret. So I thought I was going to be drowned as well as not drowned by you buggers up there. But that was just, again, typical of Dave. We circled and we found that we'd crumbled the top of the dam, that was all. Barnes Wallace had told us at briefing that he estimated that because of the structure of the Zorpa, it was like a concrete centre with a sort of pyramid building of broken rock, earth packed in tight, and then concrete again on either side. He said it would need at least 6 bombs to crack it. And if you can crack it, the water pressure will do the rest. And judging from the amount of water in that dam, I'm sure he was right. However, it would seem, and this is what surprised us, although we were half an hour late, or thereabouts, when we got there, it didn't seem that any of the other 5 had been. Nor did they arrive whilst we were there. And we didn't find out about that until we got back. So eventually, we just soldiered off. And the route home took us over what had been the Moan. And for me, that was probably the greatest satisfaction of the raid, in that we were able to see the destructive result of at least one of those attacks. And we knew that the Ada had been breached as well by radio broadcast.
What did the Mona Dam had been breached,
yeah,
by your other crews. What did the area look like?
The area was just like an inland sea. There was water everywhere, and it was still coming out of that dam 20 minutes, maybe half an hour, since it had been breached. It had been difficult to breach it, but they'd made it. And the Ada was even more difficult, but the last one to attack it, there's Knights, an Australian. His bomber was also a Johnson, Ted Johnson, but he was a flight lieutenant. They managed to breach it on their run. And that was the last aircraft there. If they hadn't made it, that one would have stayed stick to. But it didn't. It breached. And that was not so much important as far as the ammunition industry concerned, but the canals roundabout and the agricultural land and the waterways, the access on the waterways into the Harmond area.
Were you cheering and whooping in your plane when you saw that?
No, cheering quietly, yes. At least we'd seen the success of part of the raid, even though ours hadn't been quite so successful. Well, there were, in fact, 6 reserve aircrafts. They'd taken off somewhat later than we did, and 3 of those were breached for the Zorpa. They were breached once they were airborne. And the first one was shot down over almost as soon as he crossed the coast. Ken Brown, a Canadian NCO, made a similar attack to us and had the same sort of result. Sergeant Stanley was in the 3rd. The mist was developing and they couldn't find the Zorpa. And since it was getting near to daylight, he thought they'd better go home. So they came home and landed with the bomb on, which we had been briefed we weren't supposed to do. Because I think, and the only reason I think, is that the authorities weren't sure exactly what would happen with an aircraft landing with the bomb on board, particularly on Scampton, which was still grass. The idea was, if you didn't use it on the dams, you drop the bomb over Germany somewhere and it would explode with this self-detonating. The Germans wouldn't get a copy. Les Monroe, had been shot up going out crossing the coast. Apart from other damage to the aircraft, his communication system, internal and external, was destroyed. And so since it was a communications operation, there was no point in him going on. And he came back, and he couldn't discharge his bomb because his release system had been damaged as well. So he had to land with the bomb on board, and they made a dash out as soon as they'd landed to make sure that if he did go up, they're going to get out of the way first. When Anderson came back, he also landed with the bomb on board, but he got away with it. The next morning, Gibson sent Anderson back to the squadron that he came from for failing to carry out an operation that he'd been ordered to take. Sounds hard. When one considers the cost, the training, aircraft, air crews, the losses, I think it was a justified decision. We did hear subsequently, unfortunately, very shortly afterwards, the crew were shot down on another raid. When we got back, we landed at Scanton, I say, to the grass field, and landings tended to be a bit more lumpy than they were on the runway. But in our case, they were stumpy, and we were starboard wing low. And the engineer, looking out of the perspex, said, "We've got a burst tyre, skipper." So we taxied back carefully to dispersal, and the chief engineer took the aircraft off for inspection. When he came back, he gave us a severe telling off. Only he put it rather more strongly than that, for getting his aircraft shot up so much. But he could tell us the shot that we'd heard and felt had passed through the starboard undercarriage nacelle, had burst the tyre en route, had then passed through the wing and had landed in the roof just above the navigator's head. How lucky can you get? But we'd got away with it. Of course, at debriefing, we learned the end of the story. I don't look forward to war, certainly. But at that time and at that age, I felt I had to do something. I had to join and try to do something about it. And I think that's what makes my life so different from what it had been. At Lord's Wandsworth, the school motto was in Latin. In translation, it means perseverance conquers. And looking back on my life, I found how true that has been from time to time. It's pure guts going forward with what you want to do and making sure you do it to the best of your ability. Doing something that was worthwhile and doing it for a real purpose. I have to say that I feel privileged and, yes, honoured at being able to take part in that raid. Having said that, now I have to constantly remind people that I'm the lucky one. I'm still alive. And what I'm doing and what they are saying to me is not for me, it's for the squadron. And I am purely representing the squadron. Of the 19 aircraft that took off, 3 came back, had to come back early. Of the 16 that went on, only 8 came back. We lost 8 aircraft. 3 crew members had been able to escape from one of the aircraft, but it meant 53 aircrew had been lost as well. And that was a tremendous loss for one squadron, for one night's operation. And everybody felt very strongly about it. And although the bars were open in the messes and there was drinking going on, I'm quite sure it wasn't because of the success of the operation. It was commiseration with all those who hadn't come back. And that was what the drinking was about. And that was the end of it all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.